This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, it's the final bell for one of the toughest sports around at a martial arts club in Sydney. Also, one of Canada's most successful business executives and best-selling authors will tell you about her new podcast. And if COVID-19 is giving you some money problems, we'll have some advice on how to bounce back. These stories are coming up on the Coast. From farmer's daughter to global changemaker, Annette Verschuren launches a podcast to re-inspire people and communities to bet on themselves. Here she is in conversation with Dialogue's Dave Duvall.
I know you've got a podcast coming up talking to a lot of different local politicians, business people, other newsmakers, and I understand it started with a book. Can you say a little bit about the book and how it morphed into the kind of podcast format?
Yes. Dave, so in 2017, wrote a book called Bet on Me, and it sold well, but I didn't have time to market it or share it with a lot of people. And so Stan and I, my husband, came to Cape Breton March at the beginning of the pandemic, and we've been here ever since. And so it was a good time to do something like this. This idea came from Danielle Patterson and Danielle Johnson from Anchored Ideas really helped me put it together, right? I didn't, couldn't have the capacity to do this myself, but we just worked in the last year and got to talk to some really amazing people that really believe in Cape Breton, that live here or don't and come back a lot or are very vested in the island. And so it was a real wonderful experience to listen to and talk about people that have great confidence in the future of the place.
So which guests stand out to you? I understand there's a number of local luminaries there, which I should say is now up on your website. So who stood out to you?
Look, they were all great. Chief Terry Paul, Amanda McDougall, Beth Mason, Erica Shea. They were all strong leaders. They talked about what they're doing to grow their businesses and their organizations and contribute to community. It was all about place and, speaking to Ben Cohen-Dewar, who, built the first Cabot Links and how he went through that journey and how he got to where he is today and how, an idea of putting a golf course on a coal mine was so amazing. And talking to people like Gordy Sampson, who has 120 songs that he's in the middle of creating, and his influence, Cape Breton's influence on him. He comes home every summer, and, he gets inspiration, of driving in the Highlands with his truck, and, many of his songs come from the experience he has here. And so it's quite wonderful to hear people that have done well, that have achieved things, that are connected to this island and really believe in its future. And so it's very cool to share that with the rest of the island.
And, these very positive conversations are happening in a context where we've got a lot of real challenges.
Yeah.
It hardly bears repeating that we have a high poverty rate by Nova Scotian, even Canadian standards.
Yep.
There's out-migration, there's mental health and substance problems that are just really, really high and really worrying. In that context, what do you think the kind of discussions you're having could contribute to the overall task of sort of meeting those challenges?
Look, and we have, a lot of retired people here. This context is quite challenging. There's no question. And I believe, the migration out has changed. It's turned around, and I think there's 2,000 or 3,000 people that have been coming into the island for the last little while. But look, what we need is jobs. We need jobs to support this economy. And what the pandemic did prove is that you can almost work from anywhere, right? And I see this is a wonderful place to bring up a family, to grow, to build a business, to start up a business. You know, some of the things that we talked about in terms of the Verschuren Center and all the interesting things that are happening there. You know, we're taking the waste, you know, fish guts to gold is one of the podcast names. And look, we have to add value to the things that we're throwing away now. And so that whole new economy, we can own it if we start to really focus on it and invite and nurture and build up these businesses. We have a society that is expensive, and the only way to combat that is with new income, with new jobs, with profits staying here. And so these are things that can be done here in a very dedicated and positive way. And I think, look, everybody suffered from the pandemic. Everybody. And yes, Cape Breton has higher unemployment. Yes, Cape Breton has more poverty. But it has ingenuity. It has innovative people. It has, things can be done here that I really believe if you work together with government, business, and non-for-profits, you can really make things happen. And so I think there's not many places in the world that are a better place to live than in Nova Scotia. And the influx of people has been happening here. So I see this turnaround. I see young people particularly seeing opportunities here. And so we need to stimulate that. We need to encourage that because at the end of the day, you know, good economic performance, good economic income really helps the social society that and community that you're living in. And they have to be done hand in hand.
I want to sort of bring in the environmental component here because I know you're a major supporter of environmental issues. There is the Verschuren Center in your name over CBU. And actually, I remember a few years ago speaking to David Wheeler, who was then president of, or no, not David Wheeler, his predecessor.
John Harker.
John Harker.
Yeah.
He told me the story of getting in touch with you to set up that center. He told Mr. Harker told me he didn't even know you, but he just sort of ended up getting in touch with you. That seemed like a very kind of serendipitous development. I heard the story a few years ago, but how do you remember it from your side? How that got started?
Yeah, you know, I think he was asking me to become the chancellor as well at the time, and we talked about opportunities, right? And it was a time that was during the crisis, the 2008-2009 crisis, and I was working with Jim Flaherty, who was the finance minister at the time, and we were trying to come up with ways to respond, to build out, you know, jobs and to respond to the recession that was happening. And so we came up with the Home Improvement Tax Credit Program, and then we came up with this capital program that would invest in universities and all kinds of things across the country. And so it was through that concept. And I've always been interested, you know, I worked in the coal mining industry. I've always been interested in seeing what happens full circle. So John Harker had great ideas about sustainability and the environment. And so it built up from that.
Now, the Verschuren Center is now doing a whole pile of environmental initiatives, tying into the kinds of discussions you're having. What sort of, I guess, possibilities for sustainable industries in Cape Breton do you see as sort of most promising for our future?
I think we have a lot of forest products here. We have a lot of fish products here. We only 40% of the fish is used for consumption. 60% is thrown away, but it has just as much value in it. So can you imagine taking that waste and putting bugs in it, fermenting it, and coming up with cosmetics? That's what's happening at the Verschuren Center. So, you know, there's all kinds of ways in which you can take waste products and add value to them. And that's the new world. That's where the world's got to be going. We can't continue to take 40% of the fish and throw the rest away. We have got to really, you know, manage our resources in a much better way. And Cape Breton's blessed with all these, you know, all these wonderful trees, all these wonderful, you know, resources in terms of the fishing industry. Those are areas that, you know, you can produce other products out of. And that's what's happening. There's a lot of companies coming here to seek the services that the Verschuren Center is establishing. And, you know, it's really quite exciting. That's the whole biorefining business. And that's all about sustainability. It's about, you know, making a circular economy. Instead of throwing away things the way we have, it's just really much better to add value to them. We've got to take the petroleum products out of plastic. We've got to take plastic out of a lot of things. And so we can do this naturally. We can do it with fermentation processes. We can do it with adding starches and different bugs to make other products. It's really a fascinating area. And so these are some of the things that are happening at the Verschuren Center. They're also focusing very much on thermal energy and you know they're very involved in the New Dawn project, where they're taking solar energy and you know taking part of that community and making it, you know, giving it renewable energy access. So there's all kinds of things happening out there that are really positive, could really result in businesses being established here. And, you know, they're not all gigantic, but I'll tell you, give me 40 companies with 100 jobs each, and that's 4,000 jobs, you know, over one steel plant or one coal mine. That got us in trouble in the first place. So I think the approach is diversity. There's all kinds of interesting things happening in terms of the digitization of things. And, you know, we've got great fintech companies here. We got all kinds of companies that are creating different ideas and doing it in an environment that's very healthy. And so, yeah, I think there's all kinds of opportunities as big as your imagination.
Now, in terms of what's coming up on the podcast, can you sort of give any hints of what the next season or set of installments will have, or are you sort of holding that holding that back at the moment?
Dave, I'm exhausted. So, look, we don't know what will happen. But I do think that this thing is legs. And, you know, does Annette Verschuren have to do it all? Probably not. I think there are other great storytellers out there, great moderators. You know, I want the story to be told about all the good things that are happening here. And I think we can continue to do that. And so I hope it's sustainable. I don't think I've got the time to do this again, just like the way I did it. But is there a creative way to take a look at getting others involved in this? So I hope it is sustainable. I hope it draws the attention that, you know, an inspiration that I see coming out of the possibilities of Cape Breton. I talk to the young people a lot here, and they're so optimistic. They, you know, they're not so interested in talking about the past. They go forward. They're looking through the windshield, not the rearview mirror. And that's where people should be looking. And I don't waste any energy on the negative stuff. I waste my energy, put my energy in the positive stuff where things are going. And so that to me is the message I want to leave here. And it's a bit of a gift. I want to say thank you to Cape Breton for letting Stan and I be here for 16 months. It's the longest time that I've been here since I was 30 years old when I left. And so it's just been a real pleasure and a great opportunity. And I want to say, as a, you know, reasonably successful business person, look, there are opportunities here, and you can make, and you can do it, and you can take action yourself. And you don't have to wait for government grants. You don't have to wait for everything to happen. Go do it, you know, start it, make it right along the way. So I have opened all of my businesses and started all of my businesses and have fun. And that's what's really extraordinarily important.
Okay. Well, on that optimistic note, Annette, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Dave.
After 47 years together, Danny McDougall and Gilbert McIntyre are closing the Sydney School of Kickboxing, where over 20,000 people have trained. Paul McDougall from The Good Sentence caught up with them at their club at the Lyceum in downtown Sydney.
So, Danny, tell me when you and Gilbert got started on in the Sydney School of Kickboxing.
I joined Karate Club in 1975, a friend of mine, John Waverstein, actually, and we worked together at the old Cape Breton Hospital, and he said, look, we got a karate club starting down in Sydney. He said, why don't you come in? So I said, yeah, I wouldn't mind doing that. I was, you know, 1975. So I came in, and it was at the YMCA then. So I went in, and Dennis Stallion was teaching then, and Jim Maloney was down from Halifax. They had it going. So I went in, and I started, and here we are, 47 years later, and I'm still here.
When did you and Gilbert meet?
Gilbert, I started in 78. I started teaching. I started in 75, rather. I started teaching in 1978, and Gilbert came aboard in 1981. And we've been together ever since.
And so when did your school, the School of Kickboxing, that pretty well everybody in our listening audience knows of, when would that have started?
We opened up the kickboxing school in 1987. And we were really involved in karate then we started the kickboxing. Now, as to karate, you move up the ladder in karate, but you don't move up the ladder in kickboxing, you move up in a different level. So I'm saying that, like, I'm a 9th-degree black belt in karate, and 10th's pretty well highest you can go, and Gilbert's an 8th-degree black belt. You don't usually get your 10th until you're 7 years old and 70. And I'm
in our style, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't get tested until you're 70 for your 10th.
Oh, you have. There's an age component.
Yeah, and there's a year component. Like, you can't get tested this year and then get tested in the first to second, it's 2 years. Second to third, it's 2 years. Then it becomes 3 years, and then it becomes 10 years, and then eventually it's like, okay, you got to wait until you turn 70 before you go for that.
So there's an element, of course, of the skill and the fitness and all that, but there's also like an element of maturity or seniority.
Element of experience, knowledge, maturity, you know, all of that. But it's not just you're 70 years old. It's not just 10 years between tests. It's time on the floor. Like, if you get tested and then go home for 10 years and come back, don't expect anything, right? You got to be on the floor every night.
Yeah. So you two guys are totally committed to this sport.
Well, when Gilbert was saying there, when we started, we never quit at all. We just kept going. And when we started, we were going 6 days a week. We did that for 20 years.
Back then, it was the only day we didn't have it was Friday night.
Yeah.
We had a Saturday, what time is it Saturday? 10 o'clock Saturday morning,
yeah.
2 o'clock Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
And it was going all the time. And then it was Sydney School of Wei Chi Ru. And in 87, we stayed the same thing. We just added kickboxing to Wednesday night, remember?
No, I remember myself hearing of this thing, kickboxing. Do you have any idea of how many people over those years, those 40-plus years, that you would have taught, trained, whatever?
We were talking about that earlier, and you know what? We have a lot of black belts up there. People that came and went. We have people that were in here, they came as kids, and now their kids are coming in.
That's right, yeah.
Their kids are coming
in.
I'd say over the years, you know, you're talking 47 years, I'd say well over 20,000 people, I'd have to say, went through this thing, so maybe more. You couldn't really put a number on it. Our classes, our kickboxing classes, 5-6 years ago, we were getting 70, 80 a class.
Yeah, and before we were in this building, we were in the above the Capri, a smaller venue, and there was one 4-day run over there. It was on Christmas break, so the college kids were home. We did over 100 people each night for 4 nights straight.
Holy!
So, but we've had a ton of people come through here over the years, like, and really everybody's like family.
And the kids were good. Like I said, we know kids that came through here, they're married now with their own kids, but coming up, they were playing hockey in here, and it was great. It was good in there.
Well, geez,
we loved doing it.
We got trophies. Teams won trophies. You know, the provincials or whatever regional trophy. And I can show you, they're out here.
The banners, give them the doors.
But the trophies are here too.
Wow.
They brought the trophies in because they thought this is where we...
The club should have them.
Well, they said this is where we really came together as a team.
Yeah.
This is where we had the ability to play the third in a third period as hard as the first. And so they felt as a team, this is the place we'd like to leave the trophy.
Wow. That must be a nice feeling for you.
I thought it was amazing.
Well, we had Mickey Marischal. Mickey, one of our good players. Mickey won the title for us.
Canadian title.
Title. He won
national title.
Mickey's from Truro, but went to the university down here, NSCC. And that's how he started coming in the old club. And he turned up to real, real. And today, he's got two kids of his own.
Yep.
But today, he runs his own club in Truro, but he's an excellent guy. But he trained. He won the title for us. But we used to tell everybody, like, if you're going to fight for us, you've got to put the time in, you have to train. And he did. And he was in some shape. If you said be here at 8 o'clock, he was here at 8 o'clock. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we'll show you a picture of him up there when he won it. But good kid. And we all stay together. We meet once a year. They come down from Truro. We meet here, have a little party up at Hope's or something. And, you know,
nice.
We just stay together.
Rumor has it you have one of the best goalies in the NHL still to today.
Mr. Fleury?
Marc-André Fleury, yeah, he spent one summer in here. I think there might be a picture up there. No, there's not. But yeah, he was saying he was here for about 2 months, a month and a half, 2 months. First year he played with the Eagles, I think.
Yeah.
When he came out.
Yeah. We had this.
He used to laugh. He used to hate coming up here too.
Yeah. Most of them do.
So with the coach, like, at the time was Blair.
He was Blair was around then. Yeah, Blair
Joseph.
Blair kind of pushed him this way.
Yeah, like, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But another great Cape Breton fighter.
Yeah, but you know, yeah.
He had one good fight.
Well, Blair and I and Gil were still tight, eh? Like,
yeah.
Blair and I see each other once a week, and he had one good fight. He can joke about it, eh? But
I'll tell you a good Blair story. Daniel, a few years ago, got inducted into the Hall of Fame down here, right?
Daniel
Mills, yeah.
2014.
Yes.
Got inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Is it Daniel or Danny?
So he's up giving a speech, right? We're all there, and Danny's going, you know, doing this for a while, and a fella come up to me the other day and says, you know, you've been fighting for a long time. What's it like to get knocked out? And I said, holy jeez, he thinks I'm Blair Joseph.
The joke, I love it. I don't remember who first told me it. I don't know if it was Blair, but they say when he got knocked out, he was flat in his feet, and his feet were upright and on the bottom of his shoes. It said, eat a case.
Eat a case.
Simon had that, but when put on the shoes, eat a case.
I mean, the greatest piece of advertising.
Yeah.
Blair was a good little boxer, you know. He had that one pro fighting. But he won 50 amateur fights. That's that one.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he'd come up with Rocky McGill. He'd come up with Lambert McIntosh.
Yeah.
He'd come up with all those good boxes.
Oh, yeah, right.
So,
yeah, you know. And all those guys training together, you know.
He helped them move down there.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, Rudy's line about the Venetian Gardens is, if you ever dropped your towel in the training park envelope, if you ever dropped your towel on the floor down there, leave it there.
Yeah.
That's,
but I mean, you know, we were never a spa type gym.
No.
You know, we used to tell people, like, if you want to go to a gym and pay good money and have someone pat you on the back and tell you you're doing a good job when you're not even breaking a sweat, you should go find somewhere else.
Right.
If you come in here, once you pay your money, we go, okay. Now, all the abuse that's coming your way, you paid for it. Remember that, right?
Yeah.
But we wouldn't cut anybody slack. Didn't matter who you were, we wouldn't cut you slack.
You know what, Paul, when Joe talked about me, there's lots of people we had through here that didn't have the money. And
Money
wasn't a big thing for us, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We always said, we never made. Like, if the bills were paid, the rent was paid, the power bill was paid, but we'd sooner see them in working over, because a lot of people couldn't afford it, right?
Well,
and we didn't charge much. We were probably the lowest price.
We still were right till last week. We were.
Yeah.
We're still the lowest in town.
Yeah.
But the reason I took over the books years ago, I can remember nobody was paying. And Danny was pulling money out of his own pocket to pay the rent where we were. And I went, what are we doing here? Well, you know, the poor little bugger, he hasn't got any money. I said, I'm going down the road with a tool for under his arm the other day. So he's got money for some things. He just doesn't have it for others. Yeah. We have to get their priorities straight.
Yeah.
So, but still, we would. I know we had one of our black belts had a little trouble with some kids. They got in a little hustle there that could have been some legal action. He said, no, in the gym. He said, I want them in the gym. Just to teach them some discipline, some structure, right. Stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
But we've had people, geez, I can't even imagine who wouldn't have been through here. If you wanted to be a cop, if you wanted to be, if you wanted to get in shape, this is where you came.
Who's some of the guys that are still with you now training that, go back like 30 years or so?
Well, I'll tell you what's interesting with our karate club. In an era where people go and they get a black belt and they think, whoa, I'm going to hang up my shingle. I'm a sensei. I'm a master. When we line up on the front line of our, I'm an 8th degree black belt. And I line up as a student.
Right.
Daniel's the instructor. And in that line, there's a 7th degree black belt and a 6th degree black belt and a 5th degree black belt and some fourths and some thirds. Like our front line, they could all be running schools and be masters, and our masters were still students here.
Greg McKenzie's up there, 74 years old, he doesn't miss a night.
Greg,
73 back then.
Wow.
Starting 72 when Jim Maloney know that. He took time off, but then come back and been here ever since.
Yeah.
It really is kind of a fantastic, fantastic legacy, what you guys have done here.
Well,
and when you put it in this perspective of all these different people and groups of people and that have trained out of this.
I tell you the other thing, too, that's kind of comical. Over the years, because we would do different things for people around town, but we got to be known as Danny and Gilbert. And I remember you went into the... It happened to me a couple of times, but I know you went into a tavern in New Waterford and the guy turned around, I know you, you're Danny and Gilbert. By himself, I know you, you're Danny and Gilbert.
Right. Yeah.
And I've been places and they go, Danny. I go, yeah, how are you?
Yeah.
They never know which one's which.
We lost some good fellas too in killed by T.J. McClellan, J.J. Crawford. He was killed in a motorcycle accident years ago over there. Really good fella.
Mark Steele.
There's Mark up there. He fell out of the Jeep. Open. He was only Anna Steele. Remember Anna Steele?
Oh, yes.
Her son. He was only 18. Nice kid. He was over Ripley, we were going over railroad tracks, fell out of the Jeep. That was 20 years ago. And the last 2 years, Dave Murray, guy in New Brunswick, ran the biggest club in New Brunswick, kickboxing club in New Brunswick, down there all the time. He supported us, we supported him. Cancer died within 6 months.
Yeah.
John Gee, right there,
over
there, our referee. Our referee. Collision snowmobile accident.
Well, when John Gee passed,
we went up.
We jumped in a vehicle and we took off.
Yeah.
Yeah, we drove up.
And Dave Murray was a big shocker. Like, Dave was a really good, he was an 8th grade black belt. Ran a big, big club from Franklin. Had students all over.
Yeah.
And he took cancer within 6 months, but 3 months before he died, like, and he played the guitar. And we used to have our party every June at my place. And Duncan McLeod from Truro, Duncan's a 9th grade black belt like myself. And we always stayed together, and Bernie Francis. But Dave called me 3 months before he died, and he was down, and he said, yeah, we're coming. I'm bringing another buddy of mine. You'll know him when we get there. He called me in May to April. He said, well, see, the party's still on for June. I said, yeah. Died the next month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Dave was inducted into the Canadian Black Belt Hall of Fame, and I don't know if they've ever done it before, but there's a big... a big gala in, I think, Quebec, where they do the induction. But anyway, they came to Fredericton because they knew how sick he was. They came, they brought the award to Fredericton and gave him his induction there, right? It was quite a...
You miss these guys.
Yeah, for sure.
And there's a Rocky up there coming in with his wife. We put the dance on for Rocky.
Yeah.
We took the ring out and we set the ring up around the table. Remember that?
Yeah, it was neat. The head table.
In the Centennial.
There it is up there.
In the Centennial. The head table looked like a ring. Oh, were you there? Yeah.
Yeah, I was at that. That was really nice.
Yeah, it was cool.
But and, you know, and what's his name? Benton Maynard.
Oh yeah,
Maynard did like a comedy skit routine because he and Rocky went to St. Evex together. I guess they were friends.
And I never forget they were introducing. I was on the committee myself, Blair Joseph, Adie Bates.
Yeah,
and on the committee, and Adie was emceeing it.
Yeah,
at the time, and he was going around introducing anybody. And I remember Adie, my name, Martin Rocky, was sitting there, and Adie got, man, we have another over Daniel McDougal. He's got more black belts than Spinner's menswear. Rocky, get up there.
But so I just want to talk about the black belt business. Like you said earlier, 10 is the highest, but there's not a lot of people with 9s, right?
No.
Like,
I think there's myself and Duncan, Nova Scotia. Yeah. Probably, how many in Canada? Well, I don't say there's any more.
Well, Jim is a 10th.
Yeah.
Jim Maloney, right? Jim was the first one to bring our style of,
to North America.
No, the first one to bring it to Canada. George Mattson brought it to North America. Yeah. And Jim was one of George's first students, and he brought it to Canada. So he's the ranking guy in Canada. And Jim would be 10th. I think Clay is 9th.
Clay is 9th, myself, and Duncan.
That'd be it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then 8th would be me, Dave Mott. Roxanne is an 8th now, I think.
Yeah.
But it's enough that you can start naming them. Even if they're across the country, you can start naming them.
I know, That's how unique it is, and what an accomplishment for you guys.
And you can really, we can go down into the States and start naming them, you know, if we want to start 10th degrees and 9th degrees and 8th degrees.
Yeah,
right?
1/10 in Canada, probably just 2/9 degrees.
Yeah.
2/9 degrees, Duncan and I.
Yeah.
So, I'll ask you first, Gilbert, how many nights or how many days are you training now?
Well, I try to train. The wonders of nature decided to give me cancer this year, so it knocked my energy level down once I went through the radiation.
Right.
But another one of our black belts, who was dealing with it for years, I talked to him, and I said, man, my energy level is just sapped. And when you work out the way we did, in my mind, if I couldn't work out for 90 minutes, there was no sense in starting.
Yeah.
And I talked to him about it, and he asked me, he said, how you doing? I said, well, you know, to tell you the truth, my energy level is down. I'm not getting my workouts in. He said, you know what? That's the way I was. Go wherever you work, wherever your workout is set up, go and start working out. If you can only get 10 minutes in, but go. You may have an hour. You may have 90 minutes in you. You just don't know it. So it was the best advice I ever got. And I don't know why I didn't figure it out myself, but now I get up. Every morning I get up at 5 and I do an hour. I'm also a certified yoga instructor.
Okay.
So I get up every morning at 5. I do an hour and a half of yoga and then get ready to go to work. And then when I come home from work that evening, I'll do another hour and a half or 2 hours, either upper body or lower body, something like that. You know?
And it's not like you got an easy job being deputy fire chief.
Well, it was probably easier as firefighter.
We won't get into all that, but... Less human resources issues.
Yeah, that's right.
What about you, Danny?
I continue on. After COVID sort of closed us down. Yes. Like, we were going pretty steady every night of the week. Well, 4 nights a week. And then when that shut it down and we weren't opening. But we kept the karate going, and then we kept the kickboxing as long as we could, just the regular. But right now, I come in, I'm in here 2 nights a week with the karate, Tuesday and Thursdays. And 3 days a week, I try to do 5 miles each day, you know, just to keep myself. And, you know, I'm a senior now, well, I'm a senior, so, you know.
Yeah, well, if all our seniors could be like you guys.
Yeah.
So the club is, you're
we're going to keep the club going.
You're
going
to kick, the karate part of it.
The karate part.
Kickboxing part is.
It's finished.
It's finished.
Yeah.
No. It's just like, there's, Paul, it's just. There's a time for everything, and you know what, when Gilbert kind of took sick and all that, and he, you know, you gotta smell the roses, eh, right? And I enjoy it, like, I didn't realize it. People don't realize, like, we've been doing this so long, 47 years. I used to come home from work, 5, 6 o'clock, Gilbert would say, go in the house, wouldn't even have supper, go to the gym, I wouldn't be home at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
had four boys. I never had done homework with any of them.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't ever home needing.
Right, yeah.
So the last 20 years, we kind of 20, 25, we started just doing Monday to Thursday.
Yeah.
So that kind of gave you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now, I like having my Monday nights off. I like having my boys are older. They're not home now.
Yeah, it's like so much fun.
Yeah. But I like having it off. You know, I do my own thing, but I keep myself active.
Yeah.
And then I got my business, the security. That's really busy.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
So,
well, the truth is, go ahead, Paul.
How many people do you employ?
30.
30, wow.
Yeah.
The security business.
I started 22 years ago, and Gilbert ran it for me, more or less. Like, you know, and just something that's good. And, yeah, that took off for us, you know.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. It's a part-time, you know. For me, it is.
What's the name of the company? If anyone's looking for security, what's the name of the company?
Black Belt Security.
Black Belt Security.
Yeah. We're always hiring.
It's a good name. I knew the name. I want you to say it.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you the truth. Now, we have been, and I got to say this for my poor wife, because every night, you know, I mean, this is just the way it is. You do it all day. You work all day. She works all day. You throw the plates on the table and you shove something down your stomach and you're gone to the gym. And I'd get home at, like Danny said, 9:30, 9:45, something like that every night. And I can remember coming home. I live in a split-level house. So I'd come in the door and the stairs are coming up and my wife at the top of the stairs crying. And I go, what's wrong? And we had two daughters then that were 20 months apart and sleeping in the same room. Oh, she won't stay in her bed. She's over in the other's bed. She's trying to pluck the eyes out of her. They were only babies. You know, one of them. And then the dog knocked over the plant stand. There was plant and dirt all over the living room. And I'm going, I got to look sad here, but am I ever glad I wasn't home? Right?
Yeah.
So our wives carried a lot.
For
you
sure.
You know, while we did this. Now, I'd say probably 2 years ago, I started telling Daniel, I think I'm coming to the end of it. I think I want to start spending some time around the house, right? Like, and he wasn't ready. So we always had this thing. We said, as long as we're together running stuff, it takes two yeses for something to happen and one no to stop it.
Right.
So I wanted to shut down kickboxing 2 years ago, but there was one no buzzing around. Right? So I said, well, I can't leave him alone. But once COVID hit, then we had... I think at first we shut down for 4 months the first time.
Yeah.
Shut her down south for 4 months. Then you're getting, oh my God, I like being home after supper. There's a whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm still not allowed to get the remote. That's my wife's. But but you get used to it. And it's like, geez, we missed a lot of relaxation time.
Yeah.
Gilbert, like he's really solid. Like we've been friends that long. But like I said, he wouldn't... And... He never just came right up and said it, but he never let me go until we closed the town, but he'd never leave until I left.
Yeah.
So, true friend and all that. But yeah, and then we took apart. It's like I started playing the fiddle 5 years ago. Gilbert plays a bit of fiddle, but he's on the guitar now. So, you know, you get to keep different things going, eh? So, you know.
It's terrific. And, you know, when you can say, like you said earlier, you've touched like 20,000 people, right? You know,
or more.
Yeah. You know, that's all of Sydney, really, when you think of it, population wise. You've trained an entire city, or two or three cities. You know, that's fantastic. So, well, I just want to thank Gilbert McIntyre and Daniel McDougall, also known as Gilbert and Danny, if you see either one of them out, for this. The kickboxing school is wound down, but the karate club is still going, and they're easy to find if anybody's out there and interested in learning a few moves. Right, gentlemen?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
The latest BDO Affordability Index continues to paint a picture of two different Canadas, with the financial situation of Atlantic Canadians becoming graver because of COVID-19. Here is BDO Senior Vice President Paul Moffitt.
This is the fourth time that BDO is conducting this. It's a survey of sorts, and we work in partnership with Angus Reid. We did conduct an online survey from September the 1st to 7th of this year, and we did a sample of around just over 2,000 Canadian adults who are members of the Angus Reid Forum. So we've reached out to Canadians across the country and asked them questions.
So this document reveals that the rising cost of living is continuing to take its toll on the financial well-being for Canadians. And your team has a scope going from coast to coast in Canada. But how would you describe this region in Atlantic Canada compared to other regions in the country when it comes to the impact of COVID-19?
So in general, the affordability index has shown us that the pandemic, and it has shown us again, that this pandemic is eroding the standard of living for Canadians. And we've learned that, like you said, the rising cost of living and decreased income has pushed Canadians even further into debt. And to make things even worse, many Canadians aren't seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. So this year's index continues to paint a picture of two different Canadas. One Canada with the people who have, and the other Canada is comprised of people who have not. And unfortunately for us in Atlantic Canada, once again, we have fallen into the category of have not. And so with respect to this affordability index, it's the numbers that tell the story. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to give a lot of numbers, and I try not to do that. But it is the numbers that tell the story. So if I can, I want to give a few examples of in the areas of debt, as well as in savings, as well as in retirement. So when it comes to debt of Canadians who are carrying debt, we found that about just over 40% have accrued additional debt due to the pandemic. And approximately a quarter of Canadians have incurred at least one new type of debt. So it's not surprising, really, that the vast majority of these people, 7 in 10 across Canada and 8 in 10 in Atlantic Canada, the vast majority of these people are telling us that this new debt is making their standard of living worse. And about half feel that they will not be able to restore their standard of living to what it used to be before the pandemic. In terms of savings, close to around 25%, 23% of Canadians are finding it challenging to feed themselves and their families. And for Atlantic Canada, that number is actually 31%. So it's not a big surprise that 42% of Canadians reported that they're saving less money or not at all. In Atlantic Canada, that number is as high as 50%. That means half of Atlantic Canadians are saving less than they used to, or they're not saving anything at all. And about the other interesting fact that we learned is that approximately two-thirds of non-homeowners in Atlantic Canada are saying that it is unlikely that they will buy a home in the next 3 years, which is as compared to about half in the rest of the country. And the number one reason that is cited why they won't be buying a house in the next 3 years is because they can't save enough for a down payment. And the biggest reason for that is because of an increase in the cost of living and a decrease in income. Lastly, I want to talk about retirement as well. If Atlantic Canadians are telling us that they're carrying more debt and they're having difficulty putting food on the table for themselves and their families, and that they're saving less, it's no small wonder that nearly 40% of Atlantic Canadians, which is the highest in the country, I might add, have told us that they are behind on saving for the retirement. And so you see that, you know, Canadians in general are faring worse when it comes to debt and savings and preparation for the retirement. But the takeaway message here, and that I want to get through today, is that we're seeing that the situation for Atlantic Canadians is more grave in many aspects.
Why is Atlantic Canada struggling more than other families across Canada? What do your findings show you on that question?
I'm not an economist, but I do have a few different theories. One theory is that Atlantic Canada has a smaller economy than the rest of Canada. And so therefore, we are more susceptible to, you know, outside factors that have an impact on our economy. You know, and secondly, a big part of our economy, and as much as we do have a basis in timber and farming and other economies or other industries, a big industry for us in Atlantic Canada is tourism and hospitality, which, you know, as you know, has that particular industry has taken a beating when it comes to or because of the pandemic. And lastly, just in general, we've traditionally had higher rates of unemployment in the Atlantic Canada region. And one last thing is that the pandemic has made it easier for people to work remotely. And so as a result of that, I think we're seeing an influx of people from the rest of Canada who want to move here because it is a beautiful place to live. And they're able to do that from areas where they would have needed to work before. And the fact that the pandemic has taught us or allowed us to work remotely, it's easier for people to move here. And what that has done has driven up the cost of housing.
I'm not sure if this would be inside your wheelhouse there, but I'm curious about your opinion. Can we talk about some of the federal financial packages like the CERB that were offered and made available because of COVID-19? Some people are making more money from those packages than they would at their regular job, and maybe they're not so, it's not so likely that they want to get back to work immediately. Does that have an effect on the findings for this affordability index?
The affordability index didn't go into that a whole lot. What we did find is that about 4% of Canadians are continuing to receive or have continued to receive government benefits, and they are deeply dependent on them. And you are right. In some cases, the amount that somebody can earn on with CERB is more than what they used to make. And that is unfortunate, but the government has to do what it has to do in order to roll out a program for everyone. That said, you know, the government announced, and this is very fresh off the press, they announced today that they're going to put an end to the CRB, and so we will watch closely as to how that unfolds.
So this being the final assessment for 2021, what are the trends showing now? Do you think we'll rebound in the new year, in your opinion?
Like I said, I'm not an economist, and that's a little outside my wheelhouse for sure. It will be interesting to see whether the economy will rebound and whether people being, whether this the end of government supports will force people or will allow people to go back to work. And you know, it's hard to tell whether we will hit another wave of COVID and how that will all turn out. Obviously, we are hopeful as a nation that and as the world in general that things turn around.
So what's your advice for people on how they can better handle their finances because of the pandemic? And in general, are people reaching out for help?
What I've generally found is that, you know, if you are losing sleep, thinking about debt, or if you're worrying about how you're going to make your bills next month in the face of the minimum payments required on a credit card or a line of credit, if you are, you know, under a lot of stress, that's generally a good sign that you are experiencing some kind of debt problem. Now, in some cases, dealing with too much debt means adjusting a household budget, or maybe it's something a little more aggressive, like a consolidation loan, or just putting in a very specific plan in place to pay down your debts. However, if someone's debt is just too overwhelming, it's just you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. You don't see yourself getting out of this hole. It's at that time that it may mean that you may need to consider a consumer proposal or bankruptcy, and that's where a licensed insolvency trustee like myself can help. What I've generally found is that people are hesitant to speak to somebody about debt help. You know, there's a certain stigma out there about bankruptcy, and there's a certain amount of shame that comes with having too much debt, and that people are simply unaware of the solutions that are available to them. However, what I've found, what I've heard time and time and time again with the countless people that we've helped, is that we hear the phrase, I wish I'd have done this sooner. I wish that I would have spoken with somebody sooner. And so speaking to the right debt professional can make a huge difference in their lives. And a licensed insolvency trustee like myself is the right place to start.
you know, a lot of people will tell you it takes a lot of courage to take that first step and to admit to yourself, I guess, that, you know, everybody needs help in finances, or most people need help in finances once in a while. But how important is it to take that first step? And some of your clients, did they discuss that with you, that it was difficult, but they feel better about themselves once they do contact a professional?
Yeah, it is. It's just that, and I have heard that more than once. You know, I didn't want to do it. I felt like I was a failure. What I have found, I've been in this business for 10 years. What I've found is that most of the time, while in as much as people will beat themselves up, most of the time people are in the debt problems that they are not because of anything that they did. It's for the most part, it is because of situations that are entirely outside of their control. And so it's never too late to start proactively managing your debt and to help, you know, instituting, you know, budgeting solutions that work for you, or to consider paying down your debt, or, you know, sticking to a household budget in order to avoid any more debt. But if there's anyone that's listening who is struggling with affordability and debt or challenges, you know, that's no way to live. And if you feel that there's no light at the end of the tunnel, it's important to know what your options are. And so, you know, kind of my major piece of advice is that now is the time to talk to a licensed insolvency trustee to learn about your options. If you don't feel like you need to talk to a professional, that's okay. There's no obligation. You know, a consultation with a trustee is free and it's confidential. But and if nothing becomes of it, no worries. But having that knowledge base can be very helpful. And, you know, and if you don't need it, fine. But if things become unmanageable later, at least you know where to start.
Okay, so that's all the questions I have there for you, Paul. Is there anything you'd like to add or anything you'd like to mention that I haven't asked you about?
No, I don't think so. But if anybody does want to contact us, you know, we're available. We've got a 1-800 number, 855-BDO-DEBT, or you can visit our website at bdodebt.ca to schedule a free or a confidential appointment to talk about it. I mean, that's what I'm here for. We're here to help.
Okay, so on the line we have BDO Senior Vice President Paul Moffitt giving us some advice on how to deal with some of the financial problems resulting from COVID-19. Thanks a lot for your time, Paul. It was nice talking to you.
Thank you very much, Bill.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.